and welcome to From the Rookery End, a brand new sort of From the Rookery End, where we're not going to just talk about Watford as we've been doing for 14, near on 15 years now. We're going to try and do it with some numbers. No, not made up numbers, as Mike tries to do every so often, but this is going to be some hard and fast facts. My name is John, and with me for this first edition is DCW.
Hello. Hopefully this will be a slightly less, what's the right word, angry podcast than the one at the weekend. But you know, you'll be forgiven. It was straight after the match.
Not as raw. Hard for Mike to find a good place, hard for me to try and find a better place sometimes after games like that. Try and put him out that those dark sides of his fandom. But our special person for the special podcast is one Matt Furness. Hello, Matt.
Yeah, good evening. Nice to be joining you.
Yeah, no, we have been in podcast before many years ago, talking about one of our 100 objects. But for anyone, you know, I'm sure the Twitterati of Watford fandom are aware of who you are. But if they aren't, you know, can you give us, like, you are, I don't want to call you a stats, well, can I call you a stats guru? Or what is it that you sort of, you do, and how does stats work in your life?
I'm a data journalist, okay. Which is, yeah, probably a nicer way of putting it. And less nerdy, is it? I think, I don't know. but yeah, I have worked for Opta for 17 years now, analyzing data, football data especially, and trying to make stories from that data and meaningful insights, I guess.
Was that something you did before you say? It's a long time since you've been doing it. Was stats a thing for you as a kid when you were? When was your first Watford game, by the way?
My first Watford game, I think, was around 1993, but I remember the exact game. We lost 4-0 at home to Swindon, and I remember standing. And running around the family stand and seeing Glenn Hoddle smash a free kick in. That is my first memory of Watford. So losing 4-0 at home, pretty special, really. I don't think I knew who he was at the time, but I think my dad was probably saying he was really good. So, yeah, don't worry about it.
Even then, really, from then and then until you sort of work in Opta, was stats a thing that you always looked out for as a fan? Was it impossible?
Well, I played football at academy level when I was younger, but I knew I wasn't going to make it. I was never that good
for Watford Academy, or which academy?
I was actually Stevenage.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, back then a non-league team, but now it sounds more impressive than it was.
Yeah, that's important context, I think.
So yeah, I did actually have an opportunity to play for Luton when I was younger, and my dad wouldn't let me. So yeah, I stand by that, because if my kids had the same situation, I wouldn't let it either.
What could have been?
It wouldn't have been. Don't worry about it. But yeah, I kind of quickly realised I really enjoyed English. I really enjoyed maths as well. And I was kind of like pushed in that direction of originally wanting to be a sports journalist, and then kind of stumbled out of university looking for a job. And a job at Opta came up on a part-time basis. And yeah, thought, sounds like something that's quite cool and fun. I played Championship Manager at the time, so I knew quite a lot about lower league football and the stats in that game. So I thought, let's try it. And yeah, it worked out.
That was
obvious.
My next question is, did you used to play Championship Manager? Yeah.
Oh yeah, it was a prerequisite for that kind of job back then.
Yeah. The thing is, I never played that game. I was never really a computer game person. My son Eli's 10 and he's into, you know, FC 24. I can't play that game. I can't play it. I can't do what I want to do. I press the buttons, it's not doing what I want it to do. I get very frustrated, and I don't know how or where I missed the whole champ man thing. And it's fascinating, like, say, so how people approach football so differently because of things like that. And like, even his very little playing that game, you know, Eli's knowledge of players is beyond mine. Like, I think maybe it's my old age and I sort of throw things out of my head and I go, oh, I don't need to know that. I've got more important things, like how to fix things and all that sort of stuff in my brain. But it's fascinating to hear him talk about players.
It's funny. I think the fact that you've worked for Opta for 17 years, Matt, is an interesting starting point for this, because stats, data analysis, you know, it's not a new thing of football at all. And indeed, it has, for a number of years now, been more and more mainstream. You know, the advent of XG on Match of the Day, and, you know, Sky Sports Monday Night Football will go into some even more kind of detailed analysis and next-gen stats and all that sort of stuff. Mm-hmm. But you sit in the stands in Vicarage Road, or you go to watch a game in the pub or whatever, and I don't know, it still feels to me like maybe even like a sort of 50-50 toss-up between whether somebody watching football kind of is into that sort of stuff, understands that sort of stuff, or doesn't. And obviously the kind of common thing that we see a lot at the moment and have done for, you know, a number of years now is sort of frustration with passing the ball around the back, which, and I'm not saying that every person who works in data and statistical analysis is a sort of kind of evangelist about passing the ball around the back, not at all. But there's like, there are like little touch points in the game where some fans get very frustrated at the things that they see their football teams doing. And people like you and work in your sort of industry may have a different perspective as to why football teams, especially now at all levels of the game, even down to non-league, are doing things in a certain way. And I think that's a really interesting intersection of kind of modern football fandom and how it meshes with what is the professional game. Is it's almost a different sport, really, if you watch it now to like 30 years ago.
The availability of data now enables every fan to attempt at least to do their own analysis. But I do think it's dangerous. There's a lot of people that will use data not really understanding the metric that they're using or how that is collected, and what exactly it means, the definition, I guess, of that metric. So it's quite easy to, I don't know, start talking about interceptions and tackles. But do you actually know how they are collected and what a tackle is in data terms? It's very different to what you and I playing on a Sunday morning might consider a tackle won or a tackle lost. It is also a good thing because there's some great amateur, I'll call them data analysts, who don't work in the industry professionally. There's a few, even on Twitter or X, as we call it now, little Watford fans that do some really good stuff. And I think that's cool. And I think it's opening up the understanding of data to the average fan. I'll call them the average fan. It's just being really careful with how to create meaningful insight and kind of the context. Yeah. I think a lot of people can get carried away. You get a lot of social media accounts now that just spout any statistical nonsense that sounds quite funny or cool, but there's no real understanding or context to it. I mean, there's plenty of them that like, oh, I don't know, Lionel Messi, what a great game. 10 tackles, 2 interceptions, 52 passes. It's like, not that means anything. You're just listing numbers. But because they're high numbers or perceived as high, it was like, yeah, he must have had a great game. And there's that danger now, I think, with all fans that it's quite easy to find data and everyone knows you can turn a statistic into anything you want, really.
As Mr. Rees told me when I was at school, there are lies, there are damn lies, and there are statistics. Yeah. And I always took that, but what you're saying there with into the footballing way, you know, they can be either misused, as in because they're misunderstood, or inflated in a weird way. Do you get frustrated at that? I mean, especially XG, because XG is one of those things for me. I have A-level maths. I did engineering. I'm happy with numbers. Yeah, the detail of that, I've never, again, maybe not playing chat manager, never got into my blood. Do you get frustrated? Is there any sort of frustration with you with that?
I do get frustrated because part of my job throughout the years at Opta is to kind of help educate people in using data and using it the right way. And there have been times where I'm guilty of hyperbole and, I don't know, spinning things in certain ways because it makes a better story. And especially when you're working with certain tabloid newspapers and TV companies who want a great story. And, you know, if I feed them that data, it could be a back page story for my company, etc. Then you can be tempted to do that. I think over time that's become less the case. It's hard because if you're a new fan who is interested in using data in general, not just for football, and you're seeing these accounts using it in certain ways, it can be quite negative use. And I think it's quite a dangerous game to play. Things like XG, for example, the guy who created that, Sam Green, was at Opta, about 10 years ago he created that. And part of my job was to try and seed that in the football media and get that out there as a metric. I still hate the name. People instantly think it's like a pre-match thing, like how many goals do you think this team's going to score in this game? But essentially it's just chance quality, like how good we know you're having 20 shots a game, but how good are those 20 shots? You could be having 20 terrible shots, like teams used to do against Burnley in the Premier League. They were unable to get in the box and have so many shots from outside the box, but you could have four chances in a game instead of really high quality that you probably would score a high proportion of the time. You're better off having those. I mean, Arsenal yesterday against Liverpool was a great example where I think it was the highest XG Liverpool have ever faced on record in the Premier League. They didn't actually face that many shots. It was just two of the goals were essentially open goals, really, because Alisson had come out. So, yeah, it's the quality of chances in the games. And Watford have been all right this season, I think.
Oh, well, that's what we want to do. You do lots of things, Matt, and lots of stats, but not a necessarily huge amount about Watford. We want to sort of help bring it to life a little bit. But for you, Matt, you know, this season so far, how are you looking at Watford after what is near on 30 years of being a Watford fan, or over 30 years of being a Watford fan?
Last season, at the end of last season, it was the closest I came to not renewing my season ticket. I just didn't enjoy it anymore. And I think there was a great article in The Guardian by Simon Burnton about the similar thing. I think he did give in his season ticket. He just couldn't stomach it anymore. And it just wasn't an enjoyable experience. I have my now 7-year-old son, Freddie, to thank for me not packing it in, because I only kept at it because I knew he enjoyed it. And it's something I still go with my dad, and I go with my son, and hopefully my other son, who went to his first game against Chesterfield this season, will follow that course as well. So it's the one thing we kind of do as generations of family. And I think it would be, however bad last season was, I kind of wanted this season to be like a clean slate. And I think we've got that. I think that on a personal level, I'm really happy with this season. I think on the pitch, we've finally got a manager who seems to get it. He seems to get the club. I think the last manager we maybe did that was Javi Gracia. Before then, maybe, I don't know.
Zola?
Probably Zola. He seems like a hard taskmaster, which we've had plenty of those that haven't gone down well in previous years, but seems to understand on that player level of the man management aspect as well. He seems really popular within the dressing room, which is what you want for a manager, but you also want that kind of fear from players where they're like, oh, if I muck this up, then I won't be in the team next week. And we've seen that this season when players are late for meetings, they miss out, etc. I think that's a good thing. And I think I'm really happy with him, and I hope he's with us for a long time, because I can see some kind of identity on the pitch again. And we haven't had that for a long time. It's not always a fantastic identity, maybe, but you can see there's a kind of plan there. And from the off this season, from the QPR game, it hasn't changed too much. There were problems where maybe, like we saw on Saturday, a bit too much build-up and not enough getting into the final third and making things happen. I think the pace of the game was too slow, and I think there were still some players in there with a bit of a hangover from last season. I feel like as a squad now, he's happy with that small squad that we've got, because he knows he can trust those players, and it's not worth bringing in someone that could upset that. I'm really happy. I mean, I know Mike was really down after the game at the weekend.
I think he was down after both the Sheffield Wednesday performance. He'd gone all the way to Sheffield and back and seen no goals. Yeah.
But at the same time, I mean, it was one of those games that we've seen loads of those games this season where we snuck it 1-0 or lost 1-0. And I mean, Martins probably should have put his chance away. There was the free kick that hit the post, and I actually think that was a penalty. I think Barry Bannon pushed Bayo, and it was, yeah, we could have snuck that one. I know Ben Hamer made a couple of good saves as well. So, yeah, it was one of those games. But, I mean, on the face of it, I mean, we've lost four games in the last 20 league matches.
Yeah.
And across that period, we won 32 points, which is below only the current top four. So since that Sunderland game where they had it out in the dressing room after the match, it has been sorted out. Two of those four defeats were against Leicester and Ipswich. A lot of teams are losing to those two sides. And yes, Saturday was disappointing, but I think fatigue is hitting now a little bit. I mean, we had a midweek weekend last weekend. We've got another one this week. Those games are hitting fast now, whereas Cardiff on Saturday, I don't think they played for 14 games. They had a lot of time to prepare for that match. And I think Val came out today and said, we're struggling with the turnaround in games because we're not able to prepare on the training pitch. as much as we'd like to. And that definitely showed on Saturday. I thought it was a really kind of tired performance. And whilst we did get in fairly dangerous positions, mentally they looked tired, like they didn't really know where to put that final ball, where to position themselves in the box.
So statistically then, what are you noticing then about Watford? And for the good or the bad?
I'll start off with some positive stuff, because I think every Watford fan is being a bit negative after Saturday. It's a modern thing, isn't it? One single game and suddenly we're the worst team in the world. Dean Whitehead came out earlier in the season in an interview on the website and was saying, look, you know what? Like, we're not easy to beat. We're a difficult team to create good chances against. And at that point, I think he said, it actually was quite funny that he says, we're the second best team for XG. Like, it was just such a throwaway comment. And no one really knew what that meant. But we are. Like, I've looked at expected goals. So to explain expected goals for any listeners that don't understand it, as we said before, it's the quality of chance you have between 0 and 100. So a chance like a Josh Bowler's goal against us on Saturday, that'd be a low quality chance. Like, you wouldn't normally be expecting to score from those chances. I would probably put that around, 6 to 7% chance, but max. Whereas one like Vakoum Bio at Cardiff, when he had pretty much an open goal and didn't shoot, that was probably like an 80% chance. Because it's based on position of the ball, where the goalkeeper is at the time, the kind of form of play, is it open play, set play, etc.? Is it a crowded area? Have you got people in front of you, etc.? All of those things have been analysed over 15, 20 years from millions of shots across competitions to give an average scoring chance of that specific chance. So from 5 yards out from open play, the goalkeeper's slightly out of goal. How often has that been scored? So this season, Watford, defensively, the average quality of chance conceded from non-penalty shots has been 0.087, which means nothing to you at the moment. But if I tell you that means that you would expect opponents to score 8.7% of their chances against Watford from non-penalty shots this season, based on historical data, that is the second best in the Championship, joint with Leicester, only behind Hull City, who are slightly below her, 0.082.
So that's XG against, in terms of the goals we should be expected to concede. Yeah.
That is XG against. So defensively, we're really hard to create good quality chances against. And that is also shown in our open play XG conceded. Overall this season is 22. We've conceded 25 goals from those chances. So a bit more than you would expect. Some of that could be down to a certain Daniel Backman. Who knows? I'm not going to go in hard on him.
Yeah. What was the XG against of Wesley Hurt putting one in against Coventry?
Yeah. See, that wouldn't count. So yeah, that's a great example of kind of like, that's a goal that wouldn't have an XG total, but it's a goal conceded. So the only four teams who have conceded a lower XG than us from open play this season are Leeds, Leicester and West Brom. And all those are fairly close within us. Again, pretty obvious that we're quite hard to create chances against. But you look at set plays, set play situations, not so great. And I think we've obviously got a set piece coach in recently, which you've seen a difference. We don't look so susceptible at conceding from corners as we did previously. I think it was around, I can't think when they brought him in, but I think it's been maybe since the new year around Christmas.
Have you noticed
time,
that? I definitely see a difference. I think I watch corners with my heart, not with my head. So have you, Dave, have you noticed improvements in that?
I can't say I've been studying the data. I haven't been studying the footage. We just don't score many from corners, do we? But I suppose if we're not conceding that many from corners as well, that is obviously a good thing. But yeah, I can't say I've noticed, no.
The goal recently, I mean, Jake Livermore scored from a corner against Stoke, where it was a really well-worked routine where Porteous ran to the near post. I think Shaq Fadadze put the ball in. And he wasn't aiming for the goal with his header. He knew if I head it into this zone, I know Jake Livermore will be there. And it was really well-worked and that came off. But defensively, I remember the Norwich game. We conceded early on from a corner. I think that was maybe it was a high, I think it was maybe the 10th time we conceded from a set piece this season, excluding penalties. We've now conceded 11. Only one team have conceded more this season. But our XG ratio conceded, we conceded 30% of our XG from set pieces, which is the second highest in the Championship.
Right.
So that is something that I think now we have a set piece coach that will improve, but that was something that was alarming. Like that Norwich game, I remember being on Sky, and when Norwich got a corner, I think it was Duffy that scored a header. And just before the corner, they flagged up a graphic saying, oh, Watford are really poor at conceding set pieces this season. Even Sky knew it, and they knew it was coming. I knew it was coming. As soon as the corner went in, you see that zonal marking where no one really seems sure about, and I'm not anti-zonal marking by any means. I'm anti-bad defending, and that we just couldn't defend set pieces. No one really seemed to know where to go, and there was no flexibility there in that, okay, we're definitely going to zonal mark here. But if the opposition knew that was the case, they'd be like, okay, well, we're just going to put four men in the same spot and then move at some point, and Watford won't be able to cope with it. And we weren't. But fair play to Watford. They seem to have fixed that issue since. I'm sure we have other issues. That is something that I think they deserve credit for. We've been really hard to create good quality chances this season. And that was something last season, I think, that we were quite open at times, and we did concede quite a lot of good chances. So yeah, I think that's something that's really positive this season. We also, this was a stat I couldn't actually believe when I was looking at it, but I was looking at Watford, and we talked about this previously, John and Dave, about the proportion of time spent winning, drawing, yeah, losing this season. Watford have actually spent longer than any other team in a position level this season. So 62% of match time this season we spent in a drawing position. I think the next highest is Bristol City at 58%. But alarmingly, like only 16% of our minutes we've been in a winning position, which only Sheffield Wednesday 13% and Rotherham 11% have been lower. But that shows that we're kind of just really tight every game is quite close. And winning those games, like the Swansea away game was a perfect example of that. Just takes a little bit of magic towards the end, and you can pick up all 3 points in a game like that. We keep it within touching distance, I'd like to think, and that we give ourselves a good chance of winning games late on. And we've seen quite a lot of late goals this season, albeit a few equalisers later.
Yeah, that's what I had in my head. Like, my question was, does that show that we are scoring our goals for the winning positions, you know, those percentages, just doing everything so late? Does that, Dave, say anything to you about the way we're approaching games, I suppose, that we, and you could sort of say on Saturday, the fact that it wasn't until the 60-minute substitutions with those three up front did we really start pushing ourselves onto the game. Does that make you feel anything about the personality of the team, or anything about the personality and the thought process of Valerian?
I think it's very easy to want a team to be cavalier and to be attacking all the time and to score goals and to get in the mixer and to do all those things. And, you know, obviously the best teams out there are able to have more of the ball and to attack a lot of the time. But even a team like Manchester City, right? Like, and Arsenal, a lot of their success is built on defense and strangling teams and not conceding goals from set pieces, keeping the ball, but it's not like they're blowing teams away 5-6-0. I don't know what the score is against Brentford at the moment. City could be 5-0 up, I don't know. It's sensible to try and keep things tight, right? You don't want to get, and a big thing that modern coaches talk about is the danger of transitions. You hear Pep Guardiola talking about that all the time. Yes, you could go at other teams and you could really use your players to, you know, really try and be exciting and attacking and be creative and make the game open. But then you just lose the ball and you're in trouble because you've got all the players up the pitch and you get done on the counter-attack. So I understand maybe sitting in the stands when you're losing 1-0 to Cardiff, or when you've gone up to Sheffield on a Wednesday night and you're freezing your nuts off in the stands under a terrible pitch. You want them to go for it. But I understand the impulse of coaches who are under pressure, especially at Watford, to not want to kind of give the game away.
I would argue that I kind of think our some of our best performances this season have been in those games that have been slightly chaotic, and the excitement of kind of that constant transition.
The Plymouth away game, right?
I mean, the Preston game was, it was a championship record, I think, the Preston game, for the amount of shots in the first half. And Preston were, I mean, they had like 10 shots on target or something ridiculous in the first half. We found an equaliser. And in the second half, it was just as chaotic, and we blew them away. The Blackburn game was fairly chaotic. And I know we got two late goals in that game to win that game. I thought the Plymouth game was one of the best games I've seen in a long time. I really enjoyed that game. A neutral would have loved it, but it was kind of one of those games where it could have gone either way, but you always felt that we were a little bit stronger and we should have probably won that game. So I really like this Watford team when they're that chaos, because I feel like we have players that thrive in that. I mean, even more so now we've got Emmanuel Dennis. I think like Yasser Asprilla, Kone, I would say Shaq Fatadze is another one in there. Martins, all of those players are really exciting when there's space to run into. Our problem is when we slow the game down so much. And this was, again, the problem on Saturday, where they almost have too much time to think about how they're going to score a goal. And by that point, the opposition defence has got so much structure and is so deep that we just don't have enough guile in attack to really break that down. We're so much more dangerous when we let teams come onto us a little bit and we break quite quickly. I really like seeing us play like that, but I understand that is not always easy in the Championship, especially when you're playing at home. And I think that's the main reason why our away form this season is better than our home form, or it's one of the reasons. But I do agree that kind of sometimes fans need to be patient, and it's not always about that. It's about those kind of like patterns of play. As I alluded to earlier, when Val saying that we haven't had time on the training ground to be specific about those patterns of play for individual matches, I think that was something we really saw on Saturday. And again, against Sheffield Wednesday. Because I thought the Southampton FA Cup game, I thought we outplayed them for a bulk of that game. And they're a fantastic team. And I know they had four or five players on the bench who would have been the starting 11 who were really crucial to them. And when they did bring them on in the last 20, they were much better than us. I think that was coupled with us bringing on a couple of unfit players, a couple of players out of position, etc. But we were, what, 2-3 minutes away from beating Southampton, who are on a club record unbeaten run, and really, really good side under Russell Martin. I think that's got to be remembered. That was only, what, a week and a half ago. So I do think that, that kind of minutes level kind of thing is a good example of why Val likes to keep it really tight. We can sneak these games 1-0, 2-1, etc. Because he probably knows that we can't compete with Leicester, Ipswich, Southampton, Leeds. They're much better than us. They have better players, better squad, bigger squad to choose from as well. But another one that I found quite funny was that if you ended Championship games at half-time this season, we'd be in the relegation zone. We've only been winning two games at half-time this season, out of 30.
What were they?
Which I couldn't believe.
QPR.
Rotherham.
Oh, yeah.
QPR, we weren't winning at half-time, were we?
Yeah, the first game of the season. We were 4-0 up at half-time.
QPR Rotherham, yeah. And we were quite far ahead in that Rotherham game at half-time as well. And that is a joint league low with Rotherham. I mean, we've been level 21 of those 30 games at half-time. It's kind of like, don't go too far in the first half. Maybe we can pick him up in the second half. And he knows he can bring on those two or three attacking substitutions on 60 minutes, which he does regularly. And they're quite a consistent substitution. So the team obviously knows how they're going to play when those players come on. I'll go back to what I was saying before. I'm quite positive about this season overall. I think that we're seeing something happening. I mean, there's massive fears about kind of the long-term plan for the club in terms of recruitment. And everyone who is worried about that is absolutely right to be, because it doesn't really seem like there's a plan there of kind of like, well, let's bring this player in for next season, get them in the club in January and get them used to sort of training with these players, etc., and bringing them in next season. We don't seem to be doing that. And I think it was Jordan, who's on X, Watford Analytics. He's a really good follow if anyone doesn't. He was like, he thinks that it will take three or four transfer windows to correct that. And that's even if we were to bring in a really good like director of football or someone like that to do that job. So it's going to take time. Fans need to be patient. Like we're not a Premier League club anymore. Like we aren't. We never really have been. We're always going to be in that 30 to 40th best club in England. We've just got to face that. And that's exactly the same as Luton are. Like Luton are about the same as us. They're just having a really good period like we did 6, 7, 8 years ago. It's their turn now. It's going to happen. I think fans need to remember that we are that level. We're never going to be one of the best teams in England. It's fans quickly forget. And I know younger fans are used to more success at Watford, but I think they just need to have a bit more patience and less negativity around the club. I think like the negative atmosphere at the Vic this season, at times, like even when we're winning, it's kind of like, well, it's going to go wrong soon. And it's kind of like, you can't just enjoy it.
What about some of those individuals, how you're looking at them yourself, Matt, but also how statistics and sort of going at who are the sort of stars maybe for you or the standouts, maybe not that positive or negative, but the standouts this year for you?
Well, I'm in love with Edo Kayembe. I think he's brilliant. He reminds me a little bit of Steve Palmer. There's something about him, kind of just like bumbling around the midfield. But he's so much better than people give him credit for. I think when he first joined, he was a January signing, and he joined in a struggling Premier League team. It was just really difficult. Like any team, any player that's having to play under Roy Hodgson is very difficult. Then last season, the thing about Kayembe was he played a lot deeper in the midfield, but also he would take quite long in possession and he would have to get it on that left foot. And it would be kind of like, they've got their defensive structure back now, because Kayembe's taken 3 or 4 seconds to get
it. He never looked comfortable receiving the ball from the defence, really, did he?
No. But I think that was because of the position he was playing in. This season, he's playing much further up the pitch. And you've got the perfect three for me is Livermore behind him and Kone alongside him. Kone is so much better when Kayembe plays. Last season, he averaged 10.3 touches in the attacking third per 90 minutes. So that was 16% of his total touches. This season, that's up to 14.7, but that's 27% of his touches are in the final third. So he's getting in his positions. I mean, the game that obviously stands out for us is that Preston away game. I thought he was excellent in that match, and that through ball to Bayo for his second goal was fantastic. 8% of his touches have come in at zone 14, which is that kind of central position outside the box where you kind of want a creative player. But he is also one of those players that he's really good at winning the ball back high up the pitch. So if you activate that kind of press, that team press, him and Kone are very energetic and can do a lot of that work. Whereas Livermore is perfect because he is that coach on the pitch and he can marshal that midfield. Now, this is going to be really difficult when Kayembe comes back, because our best player since the start of the year has been Chakwetadze. I think he's been phenomenal. I really like the way he plays. He's exciting to watch. He'll take the ball to the opposition. He'll run at them. But I feel that his quality has been detrimental to Kone. And Kone is he's our star, isn't he, really? He's got such a high ceiling. I mean, he's still only 21, which is ludicrous. His ability to turn speed, and it makes it look so easy at times. Brilliant. I love watching Kone, and I think everything you do, you've got to make your best player be more comfortable. So if that means dropping Chakwetadze again, I'm afraid that's what we've got to do. Whether or not we could play him wide, I don't know. I don't think he's going to change his shape, and I wouldn't want to see Kayembe drop into that defensive midfield position again. It's been no coincidence that since Plymouth we've looked a bit more shabby in midfield. That first half, Kone and Kayembe, they both scored, didn't they, before he went off, and were playing really well together. The thing about Chakwetadze is, so I've looked at something which is looking at kind of sequence involvement. So sequence involvements are basically passing move involvements that end in an open play shot. So far this season, only 5 players who have played 900 minutes or more have a higher sequence involvement per 90 than Chakwetadze. So he is really involved in all our attacks, as is Yasser Asprilla. I think he's just a little bit down with 6.3 per 90. But Chakwetadze makes things happen. But on an individual level, I think Kayembe is better for the team. And I think the team gels and is a more solid proposition as an 11 when Kayembe is in that midfield. I laughed at the club for introducing those cushions where you could buy a player and their number on the back. But I think I might buy a Kayembe cushion. The other one I really want to talk about is
before you do, I've got a question for you.
Yes.
Can you explain what Zone 14 is? I've never heard of that one before.
Zone 14 is the square. So if you break the pitch into squares, it's that square outside the penalty area. Like, you know, the D or the edge of the penalty area. It's that kind of position where you would see Messi pick the ball up all the time. Okay. Odegaard.
The number 10.
Brilliant
spot.
At picking the ball up there. Yeah, number 10 spot. So Zone 14. Yeah, I'm going to bring that. I mean, it's a fairly common thing in those tactical. Michael Cox will use it a lot. It's one of those tactical aficionado.
Knowing Michael Cox as I do, I bet he has never ever written the word Zone 14.
Surprisingly
anti-jargon. Yeah.
Well, I tell you what, I'll put it into the podcast title at least.
Yeah. He's our Zone 14 king. And I'm going to move on to the switch king now, which is Wesley Hoot, who has played every single minute of football for Watford this season in the Championship. He's one of only three outfielders to play 2,700 minutes this season alongside Matt Grimes, who is equally as important for Swansea, and Kenny McLean, who I don't know if he's as equally as important for Norwich City. He sounds like a country western. but yeah, we are a small squad. We've used 24 players this season. That is the fewest alongside Bristol City and Coventry. So having someone like Wesley Hoot as a consistent figure is really important. He is a phenomenal passer of the ball from the back. And so much of our play begins with him. He is everything that Ryan Porteous is not. He can pass a ball. He doesn't lose his head and storm out of defence like a madman. Which I don't think is always a bad thing. It's quite fun to watch. But yeah, Porteous makes me nervous. So this season, Wesley Hoot is that player. And you will have seen this. If you watch Watford this season, he loves that crossfield ping, that switch. He does it more often than any other player in the Championship. In fact, he's done it more than about three times as often as any other player in the Championship this season. He's attempted 92 switches of play. 57 of those have been successful. Majority have hit the feet of Yasser Asprilla and Ryan Andrews. Both of those are quick players who can get the ball at their feet and as soon as they get that switch can attack, where there's hopefully a bit of space in behind the fence because we switch the ball quite quickly. Hoot's ability to find that pass, I haven't seen many Watford players that can hit a pass that well over long distances.
Marco Cassetti, love a crossfield pass of Marco.
Yeah, similar errors as well, those two players. He is also really good at receiving that pass quite quickly on the left side of defence and playing that really nice kind of like curved pass up to Martins or something, which looks perfect from the rookery quite often. Mm. Really good vision. But also interestingly this season, he is the player in the Championship who's one possession back from the opposition to start passing moves that end in shots or goals more often than any other player this season. So he started 14 passing sequences that have ended in an open play shot and five that have ended in a goal. Both of those are Championship highs this season. A lot of that obviously is down. He plays every minute, so he's going to be a bit higher. But it also shows how important he is to building up the play for Watford. So when he regains possession, we usually can get that ball quite quickly up the pitch because of his range of passing and have attempts.
Early in the season, again, when Backman wasn't having his amazing spell, it did seem that the reason Wesley was doing so many of those passes because he was the only person that Daniel Backman would ever pass the ball to. He's like, out that way, over to the left. And he got the ball. And it's actually taken a while to go, no, that's actually, it isn't just down to Daniel only wanting to pass it towards his left and doesn't like passing it to his right. Wesley is important. How important do you reckon he is, though, Dave? Is he the most important player? If they got injured, what do you think? Or do you think, is it Mr. Livermore or is it someone else?
Well, it's interesting hearing those numbers, you know, and it does pretty much backs up what we see with our eyes, you know, albeit that maybe this is just sort of the natural tendency of football fans to all of us to sort of err on the negative rather than the positive. I can certainly picture a lot of times where he's passed it out of play and I've got annoyed about it more than perhaps I have in terms of his I'm surprised at how many of those balls he's attempted, because I have thought in my, I have sort of felt like at times he hasn't done as many as he sort of was doing at the start of the season, but the numbers don't seem to back that up. But
well, I think that probably is the case, actually, Dave. Right, okay. I think that teams have got quite wise to it. And on Saturday, I thought Cardiff were pressing him quite a lot, especially in the first half. And we didn't cope great with it. We talked the other day about kind of how we saw so many passes between Hamer, Hoot and Pollock. And it was kind of like he was forced to make those short passes back to Hamer because he was being pressed quite quickly by Cardiff. So they obviously knew that. And these clubs have access to all this data as well. So they know, like, so much of our play comes through Hoot, and it's such a frequent pass that he makes. So just stop that, cut it out, because Watford like doing it. So yeah, we saw that on Saturday.
And then I suppose the problem with that is that we don't have another centre-half on the other side who can do it in the other direction. So teams will want Porteous to have the ball.
Can you imagine having to play out the back with Pollock and Porteous?
Yeah.
Disaster waiting to happen. That is my worry. I mean, Hoots, I think he's one yellow card away from a two-match suspension, isn't he, as well? So it's going to happen sooner or later. I personally think he probably is our most important player because of who would replace him. We seem to have a bit more like for like in other positions.
And it's the left-footedness as well, right?
Yeah. And I know we tried to bring in a centre-half in January, and I'd imagine it probably was a left-footed centre-half, but never happened. I mean, the worry would be if Bayo and Rajovic got injured at the same time. What the hell would we do? Like, we have to play Porteous up front or something like that.
Maybe that's his role. Pollock. Maybe we're just thinking too much about him in defence. Stick the boy up front, see what happens.
Well, we've seen centre-half start up front for Watford in the past. I think Demerit and Shittu both had a game where they were put up front by Boothroyd at some point.
But the opposite, Marcus Gayle. Yeah,
of course.
Yeah. Chris Sutton and Dion Dublin were the kind of memorable Premier League centre back. This is like Championship Manager, and we have CBCF as the kind of like the dream. Like, I mean, we've obviously got Dennis now, who could play for the middle, but Val is so reliant on. He likes having that physical presence as a nine, who will press. Which kind of brings me on to another player I want to talk about, Mileta Rajovic, who.
Okay, that's the noise. In terms of your statistics, I know you can look back at different things. So not only what you see with him now, but things you might have seen in the past. Because Dave and I went to Stockholm for a weekend and we saw the local derby, and it was an amazing game of football. One player has been signed by Tottenham, though.
Yeah, Bergvall. It's gone to Tottenham.
Yeah, but he's 18.
He's 18, but he was like, oh, he's quite good, but he's big, bright, yellow hair. So maybe that was the reason why he stood out. But Rajovic came from the team that was, they were like, what were they?
Omar, yeah.
Yeah, what were they at that point, Dave? They were like seventh and ninth. And they were in the middle. He came from the club that's in the middle.
They were sixth or seventh. And the two teams we saw, Hammarby and Djurgården Gardens, were, Rajovic's old team were the sandwich, were the filling in between the Hammarby and Djurgården Gardens sandwich.
So go on then. Explain your,
I caught wind that we were signing this guy a few days before we were. So I did a bit of research on him. Lucky enough, through work, I have access to kind of like clips and footage, scouting tools, where I can watch like anything he's done in Sweden. And I actually had a few clips from his time in the second tier in Denmark as well. So I did a bit of research before we joined. Right. So I remember watching him in those clips and I was thinking, bloody hell, he's slow. Like I couldn't believe how slow he was. Like, his turn of pace was, I hadn't seen a striker that slow. Like, I was thinking, that's a bit alarming. But saying that, like, watching a lot of his shots at that time, his movement off the ball was really good. So he didn't rely on his pace at all. He was able to get in front of a defender because he could read the cross or the pass coming in before the defender. Now, that was in the lower half of Sweden and also in the Danish second and third tiers, which are, I think someone brilliantly pointed out, we've signed a player who keeps scoring in front of car parks, which is Yeah, I know him as the car park king now. I just like to think that he's at London Coney, like just practicing in the car park and like going, I can score, look. So he might have installed a goal in the car park. But I mean, I then looked at his data. I unfortunately didn't have his data in Denmark, but I had his data for 6 months or so. He was in Sweden. And like he, for a 6'3", supposedly dominant aerial striker, he won 43% of aerial duels, which was, again, fairly alarming. When we signed him, the club article said he was a towering physical presence who also possesses plenty of technical ability. I mean, I would be asking for my money back. Like that, he has not got plenty of technical ability. That clearly isn't the case. But there's something I can't shrug that makes me think we could turn him into a good player.
Yeah.
Like he is 24, so he hasn't really got time on his side. That is not young in football years when you are coming into a championship level team. He can score. Like, we know that. He can score from those chances that he's a bit of a fox in the box, except he's not a fox. He's more of a box in the box. And that he's... Reminds me, his shoulders are a bit like Chris Owolumu's, where he's just, like, really like Alice the Goon from Popeye. You know, like, really high kind of, like, shoulders. But he seems like a really likable guy. And I get quite defensive when Watford fans are negative towards him. He's a guy that is living the dream. Like, he's come from the Danish third tier, really, and then the second tier, where he'd played for a few seasons. He'd had less than 6 months in Sweden, where quite a lot of his goals came in the Swedish Cup against probably lower league opposition, I believe. And it's going to be really hard for a player to come in after a season started, without a pre-season, pick up that massive jump in quality in a new team, having to learn a new way of playing. And I think he's done all right, really. Like, goal record. And he's done what we'd expect from a striker who is second choice. The failings are with the recruitment team of not bringing in another striker so that we don't have to rely on him so much, not him. And I think, yeah, like, it was a quite a high transfer fee, but I think it was... there's a guy on X called Tim Keach who's like he's like a football recruitment data guy. And he was saying the other day that there just aren't those number nines around. Like, every club's kind of like, oh, well, I can't believe we didn't get a striker. Find one. Find one at this level who is that number nine. You just don't get them anymore. Like, you get those kind of number 10s that play as a false nine, as a kind of like, more like a, I guess, a Gabriel Jesus kind of player, who's not your Erling Haaland, big hulking centre forward. And teams just don't play that way anymore. We are one of those teams who want a big guy, and they're just really infrequent to find. So I get why they signed someone like that, because there aren't many around. He was a bit of a gamble, I guess, but in terms of transfer fee, I think it was $1 million we paid, 1.5 million. That's quite cheap nowadays, isn't it, for a striker?
Yeah.
For a rare position. And I'd say the goals he scored so far have probably paid around that. Like, he's got some winners, he's got some equalizers, some pretty important goals. Even when, like, I think he got the second goal against Norwich that basically made us think that, oh, we could go and win this now. Like, he scores at pretty decent times, and I do see some improvement in his play. And fans, it's like the Daniel Backman thing, they've already made their mind up about him. They're negative towards him when he goes, oh god, Rajovic just come on, like, we're not going to do anything now. There is still a threat there. And I think that the Chesterfield header was a brilliant header, really good header, got in front of the defender. And I know it was against a non-league team, but they're not a non-league team. Chesterfield are a League One, League Two level team. They're a really good side. And it was a good goal when we needed it the most. We were 1-0 down at that point. And not many Watford players would have scored that goal.
Yeah.
So I think that he has a place in this squad, and he will get a couple more important goals between now and the end of the season. And my hope is, with a pre-season, he might be able to refine his game a bit more. And there's going to be so many bad habits he's picked up. And I'm sorry, Danish second tier, I'm not mocking you, but coaching methods in the Danish second tier are probably nowhere near the level of what they are at the Championship. And he would have picked up bad habits that have stuck with him now because he hasn't had the time to build on those.
It's a really interesting perspective. And I think like the thing that keeps him hanging in there, as you say, is that despite all the obvious technical and even physical deficiencies that he possesses, he scored 9 goals. You know, that's not an easy thing to do. It's more than any other player we've got. So you kind of have to say fair enough to that. But it's funny that the first thing you picked up on was how slow he is. Because Christ, like, I've never seen anyone like run in such a weird, awkward way. I think he needs to like have some time with like a sprinting coach about his like running technique. He's like, he runs like dead upright and barely moves his arms.
But I think this is where I was alluding to, like the bad habits kind of thing. Like he hasn't had that championship kind of level, Premier League level academy kind of like upbringing where those sort of things would have been drilled out of him at 15, 16. And I think he was at a fairly decent academy in Denmark, maybe Copenhagen or something like that. But yeah, I think that those sort of things over the last few years, it's like when we sign players like, we talked about this before, like Scott Fitzgerald. Do you remember like, it's that kind of player
who could do nothing else but run around fast.
No, and score. Yeah. He was just quite good at scoring. I just feel quite protective of him. I really want him to do well. I think it's a really nice story. He seems like a really decent guy. And just naturally, I think, like everyone picking on him, I kind of like, oh, give him a break. Like he's come from the Swedish league. It's not the level of the championship. We know that. It's quite below. It's probably like League Two level, really, on average. And he hasn't had a preseason with the club. So let's reserve judgment. Admittedly, I was surprised when he was linked to Ipswich. but maybe they've seen something in him. Maybe they really want a slow striker.
Bring him on, you know, we win the game, just slow things down a little bit.
I don't know. I think they've got a few fields that need ploughing over in that part of the world, eh? So.
Also, in defence of Rajovic, like our distribution isn't tailored for him, is it? Like,
no.
There was a point, I can't remember what game, it might have been Sheffield Wednesday when he came on, where we broke and he was like pointing like to the player running through, like, play it through. And the player's like, nah, you're all right. Like, you ain't getting that, you're too slow. But you saw the Rotherham game where two crosses came in. First time finishes, both of them, brilliant finishes. He's great at finishing crosses. His header against Birmingham was a brilliant header. Mm. He's got strengths. We just don't play to them. And if we're talking about Rajovic, we probably need to talk about Bayo. Again, I think it's had a rough time from Watford fans over his period at the club. I think he's improving. And I think
I say he's probably won a lot of people over this season, I think. When you consider the nadir for him was when he trudged off the pitch against Blackpool, wasn't it? In that game,
that was unfair.
Adeyemo scored, and then he went out on loan, and it was like, you know, we probably thought at that point we'd never see him again. But he's come back this season. I'm still annoyed that he didn't get a hat-trick against QPR, which would have made me a very rich man. And he should have got at least 2 that day. But to be fair to him, and maybe in part of this is his sort of comparison to Rajovic, and that he looks more lively than Rajovic now. I think he's worked his way back into the sort of the good books of the fans, if you like.
He's not a great finisher. So whoever nicknamed him the Crow, my God, they are wrong. Like, he is not a Crow. I think that he's one of those players that he offers more to the team, doesn't he, in that role. He is the best we have in that position. So we've just got to make do with that. I mean, he's not a brilliant player, but he's an honest player. We like those. We like honest players at Watford. And both Bayo and Rajovic are that. And I think that as a mid-table championship club, they're all right. Like, they're okay. Like, we're not going to go up to the Premier League with those two, but we are what we are this season, and that is something that next season will hopefully rectify. And those two will be, I don't think both will still be at the club next season. I'd be surprised if both are still here, but I feel like one of them will still be able to do a job as long as we bring in someone else.
So you don't think we're going to go up then?
I hope not. I really don't want to go up. Yeah. I don't want to go up because what's going to happen? We'll go up and just get smashed next season, like, because we need a massive overhaul of the squad. I'd rather take 3 or 4 years to come back. And I know Watford fans will go, well, we can't let that happen because we won't have the money, etc. But do you need the money anymore? Luton had the smallest budget in the Championship last season. It's being clever, isn't it, with that recruitment, how you play, and maybe getting in a really good manager like Rob Edwards. Maybe we should try that.
Thank you so much for your time, gentlemen. This first sort of another way we like to do things from the Rookery End, not just overly react to everything, but we also like to have a think and have a deeper look into things. And your input, Matt, has been fantastic. And hopefully everyone enjoyed it. We'll try to do these maybe once a month and see how things go. So thank you very much, DCW.
Thank you.
And thank you very much, Matt.
No worries, thank you. I'm just off to buy my Kayembe cushion now.
We'll be back with another podcast after the weekend game against Leicester. Come on, you horns!